Welcome to the Beyond Sunday at WMPC podcast. For this Lenten season, we invite you to join us as we explore Lent for the Lost, Longing to be Found. In this seven-week series leading up to Easter, we will look at the lectionary passages from the book of Luke. In preparation for the second Sunday in Lent, we hope you'll listen as Pastor Christopher Edmonston, an associate pastor for small groups and young adults, Ann Gallagher, explore Luke 13, 31 to 35.
Hello, everybody. I'm Christopher Edmonston, the pastor and head of staff at White Memorial Presbyterian Church here in Raleigh. And today I'm joined by my colleague, Ann Gallagher, who is our associate pastor for young adults and small groups. Is that right? No, it is right.
Well, technically, but
small groups and
first.
Young adults.
Yes,
that's
there we go.
Small groups and young adults. And we're here as part of our Lent for the Lost, Longing to be Found podcast series, where we're going to take the scriptures through each of the Sundays during the season of Lent and actually look a little bit deeper into them as we prepare to preach from them, and use them as the start to our liturgy each and every week. Before we do anything else, we are so glad that you are joining us today, and we want to thank the other staff members who will be contributing to this podcast series during the season of Lent here in the year 2025. The text that I'm going to be reading today is one that I'm going to be preaching on myself coming up here pretty soon, and it's from Luke chapter 13, verses 31 through 35. So I'm going to read that, Anne, and then see if anything in there jumps out at you, so that we can maybe look at this text a little more intentionally together.
Love it.
Together. So Luke says this at verse 31. At that very hour, some Pharisees came and said to Jesus, "Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you." Jesus said to them, "Go and tell that fox for me, 'Listen, I am casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. Yet today, tomorrow, and the next day I must be on my way, because it is impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you are not willing. See, your house is left to you, and I tell you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord.'" That's the end right there, verse 35. So 31 through 35 of chapter 13. There's a lot going on there in five verses, Anne. Mm-hmm. There's a whole lot going on there. Yeah, for example, in Luke, typically the Pharisees are seen as being pretty pretty mean to Jesus, and they're constantly his opponents. Mm-hmm. And yet at first glance, the Pharisees come to Jesus and say, "Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you." It's
Which
almost like they're trying
protective.
To be there. It does feel protective. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way a lot of people have interpreted it. Mm-hmm. The problem there is, I think something else is actually happening.
Oh, do tell.
I think it's another trap. Well, for example, there's this ancient tradition that Jesus refers to about how a true prophet of God could not die anywhere outside of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Okay? And essentially, Jesus has to keep going to Jerusalem if he is who he says he is. He cannot stop the sort of the march towards Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And if you go to other texts throughout this whole section of Luke's gospel, Jesus is always walking towards Jerusalem, and Luke will drop these little clues like, "And so he continued on to Jerusalem."
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
it's lots of momentum there, just so much momentum, right? But if Jesus says, "Herod is going to kill me," you're right, unless I get off the path to Jerusalem, then he's really not a prophet of God.
Mm.
And so it's a trick question.
Mm-hmm.
You should be running from Herod in the opposite direction.
Right. They're kind of double crossing him.
It's complete.
Yeah.
It's a complete double cross. It's like a rope-a-dope. It's like a head fake on a football field. And Jesus sort of sniffs it out once again, which is pretty remarkable. There's a reference in here to the resurrection. "Go and tell that fox for me." Foxes in the ancient rabbinical tradition were considered cunning animals, very cunning animals. Go and tell that fox for me, listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. So, right, I'm not going anywhere. The day that you should be worried about is the third day.
Right.
The third day.
That's an interesting sort of interplay, too, of imagery between the fox and the hen. Like, one of the things that stands out so much to me from this text is that image of Jesus saying, like, I've longed to be like a hen gathering her brood
under her wings,
which is such a gorgeous metaphor for the way that God, you know, brings us into the fold. But that's, an interesting contrast between that cunning fox and then this sort of nurturing hen that Jesus is saying that he's like longing for, that's the relationship he longs to have with God's people.
That's what he wants to do, is nurture and protect, right? That's basically what he says, how I have longed for this. And that's actually an image from the Psalms too. Like, this is like, I will not forsake you, like the mother bird who takes her brood under her wings. I always think of those images sometimes that you see from forest fires where, you know, the mother bird is like dead on the ground and they pull what's left of her body back, and the little chicks are down there in a hole that she dug.
You know,
it's pretty incredible when you think about the power of that image. And I like how you juxtapose that with the fox there as well. Absolutely. The key thing there, the mother hen gathers her brood under her wings, and then the English, it's comma, and you are not willing. Like, you and Jerusalem, you don't want my protection. You didn't want it. One of the strange things that's going on here in the historical critical, do you remember, do you remember that word from school?
Oh, yes. Bringing me back.
In the historical critical is Jesus lamenting Jerusalem in the future, what's going to happen, or is it a lament for the past?
Right.
You know, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I longed to protect you, but you weren't willing.
Right.
The truth about Luke's gospel is it was written after Jerusalem had already been destroyed.
Fallen,
right? That's when Luke finally got down to whoever Luke was, compiling all the different strains of the story of Jesus to writing his sort of Jesus story, his gospel.
Right.
And so some scholars think that it's very much looking back, like, I tried to save you, I couldn't.
Right.
I lament that, or it's a projection forward looking to the crucifixion and resurrection that haven't happened yet in that sort of time. I don't think it matters to me very much. I do think that we went to school with some people that got really, really fired up about making sure I know the date this was written and who was the writer. To me, narratively, it's another reminder that these Pharisees are not easy customers, and that Jesus's goal in the Gospel of Luke, like the rest of the Gospels, is to get to Jerusalem. And along the way, he's going to help some people. Go tell that fox, today and tomorrow, I'm curing people and casting out demons, right? And I'll be done. I'll finish everything on the third day.
Right. And thinking about, so we have these two sort of options for what Jesus could be pointing to or what Jesus could be referring to. But then another sort of third way would be thinking about that sentence, but you were not willing, being an opportunity to read ourselves into the text. Like, how often, especially in the season of Lent, which has this invitation to confession and repentance and self-reflection, how often do we find ourselves unwilling to be, you know, pulled into the stream of kind of God's love, God's will for the kingdom on earth because of our own, you know, our selfishness or our conceit or whatever it is.
Self-satisfaction.
Yeah.
Like, I'm satisfied with what I know about this, and I don't need God telling me what to do.
Right.
That's what I mean by self-satisfaction.
Yeah, and the idea of, at the time of this podcast recording, dear listener, we have just heard a sermon from Reverend Edmonston about Jesus resetting our expectations. And so often, maybe that unwillingness comes from a feeling of not wanting to be uncomfortable and not wanting to have our assumptions challenged. And that's another thing that we're invited to do in Lent, is to kind of lift those in the light of God's love and see where we might be challenged, where we might change our mind about something.
Yeah, because maybe if we feel spiritually lost, were lost, you know, at least according to Augustine, according to Calvin, according to the old church fathers, if you're spiritually lost, you're probably responsible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that self-delusion. It's that self-idolatry.
Sure.
That's the worst one.
Right.
And sometimes in order to be found by Jesus, if you're lost that way, you've got to be willing to give up some of those illusions about your own motives.
Mm-hmm.
Or else you'll just stay lost.
Right.
It's one of these sort of funny things. And that may be part of what Jesus is doing, all these challenges with the Pharisees. And they're over and over again. And Luke, the Pharisees keep inviting Jesus over for dinner. They keep inviting him to sit down and answer questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens over and over again. And Jesus is, I think, in Luke, maybe more than some of the other places in the Bible, convinced that they are confused by and lost in their own self-assumptions about how righteous and how right they are.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
he sees them as lost in the Gospels, and particularly in Luke. Same thing could be said of us.
I mean,
I'm at my worst when I'm completely sure that I'm right.
Oh, same. When we don't have any space left for sort of like an intellectual humility or a faithful humility, a willingness to say, I could be wrong about this. That's really hard for us to say sometimes.
It is really wrong to say. I could be wrong, but here's where I'm at today.
Right.
I sometimes think we could save a lot of people in America from shouting at each other just by giving them that one phrase. I could be wrong, but here's what I'm thinking.
Right.
I could be wrong, but here's how that position of yours is making me feel.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, again, we can get lost as easily in our own self, the creations of our own sort of self-made prisons as we can in anything in this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
One last thing I want to point out, just real quick. Verse 35, if you're studying this at home, it's almost untranslatable. It says, see, your house is left to you. So in other words, I tried to house you like the mother hen, but you weren't willing. So your house is left to you. Some translations say, see, your house is abandoned. Mm-hmm. And I spent some time earlier today looking into some really technical commentaries where people really get into the Greek, and it's unclear. There's not a whole lot of places where it's unclear. So what I think is better if you're studying this at home is to skip that sentence and go to the next one. Again, I say to you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, which of course is what day? End of Lent.
Easter. Uh-huh.
Not Easter, the one before.
The end of Lent. Wait.
Palm Sunday.
Oh, sorry. Okay, yes. I'm with you. I'm tracking with you.
I just stumped the preacher.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, I did.
Mm-hmm, yep.
But that's
intellectual humility.
That's right. That's Palm Sunday. And of course, if you do any Bible study ever, you know that also, like the mother hen was a quote from the Psalms. That's mm-hmm. actually a quote. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. That's a quote from Psalm 118.
Mm.
So there's a lot going on in five verses. We've got the imagery. We've got the juxtaposition mm-hmm. between the fox and the hen. We've got the Pharisees with a little wink, wink, you know, that mm-hmm. we're here to help you, but really we want to see how you're going to pass this really complicated text.
Mm.
We've got Jesus lamenting. And then we've got other biblical references too, all in just five verses that
chock full.
That I don't think anyone would read if they weren't in the lectionary, you know, for the second Sunday in Lent.
Right. So, yeah. Well, before we talk a little bit about Lent in general, I am just thinking about what an opportunity has been presented to me to be in the presence of someone who has spent so much time in Luke's gospel. And so it seems I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what is it about Luke's Jesus that is compelling to you?
That's a really great question. I have spent a lot of time in Luke's gospel. I think anybody that preaches a lot, and I do preach a lot, and I think I would anywhere that I would mm-hmm. be. In any church, you preach a lot if you're the head of staff, pastor. We all have our places that are like home base, and mm-hmm. Luke is probably mine.
Yeah.
And then my wrestling partner is typically Matthew, like the one that I want to like.
Ooh, I like that.
I like to wrestle with is Matthew. And then Mark is like my dinner buddy.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And John is the person I like to go on long walks with.
Yes. You know? Yeah, really heady.
Really heavy, long walks with. But Luke's sometimes called the gospel of the lost. And actually, our buddy Greer Richards gets to pray on some of the preach on some of the parables of the lost right as Lent is coming to an end. And in fact, that's part of why we have this title, Lent for the Lost, because we're in Luke's gospel. And there's just all these parable after parable, the parable of the lost coins, the lost sheep, the lost son, that keep coming up in Luke's gospel. Luke always has a concern for those who feel left outside in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus is constantly trying to enter the open the door wider so that more people can come in.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes Luke's called the gospel to the Gentiles,
mm-hmm.
which means that those who are outside of the 12 tribes of Israel long ago. My favorite chapter in the Gospels probably to study and to teach on is Luke chapter 7, and so much happens in Luke chapter 7, and we don't have time to do that today. But like when I say the gospel to the Gentiles, the centurion comes to Jesus and wants Jesus to heal a person in the guy's household. And Jesus says, he's got a little comment, and the centurion says, "Only say the word and my servant will be made well." And then Jesus looks to the crowd and he says, "Never in Israel have I seen faith such as this."
Right, from the centurion.
From the centurion. Yeah. Like the guy that's commanding the army that's keeping the Israelites, you know, underfoot.
Right.
He's saying he's got more faith than we do. And,
yeah.
And we're the ones. So when we say gospel to the Gentiles, that's what we're talking about.
Right.
At the beginning, Luke's got this dedication to a man called Theophilus. And whether Theophilus was real or he's made up, because Theophilus means lover of God, the one that loves God, it's still a Greek name. That's the dedication, is a Greek name, not a traditionally Israelite or, you know, Middle Eastern name. And so that's why I love Luke. I just, I find those themes so compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I find Jesus and Luke with the unique material, because this text is unique to Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere else. Like the Good Samaritan, nowhere else. There's things in Luke that aren't found other places. And so I fell in love with it a long time ago in seminary.
Yeah. Well, and things that it's like you can't imagine. It would just be a huge loss not to have Luke's voice, because some of those, like the Good Samaritan, like what a picture of Jesus that's so central to our understanding of who he
is. Of everything we do.
Right.
Particularly at White Memorial.
Oh,
that
sure.
That is central to everything that we believe about ourselves and about what we think our call in the world is. You know, I said the lost son, but that's better known as the prodigal son. Like, that's almost a gospel within the gospel.
Sure.
Like, it's hard to imagine knowing who Jesus is without the prodigal son. And then, of course, you know, we wouldn't have the Christmas story without Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Luke's where we get the manger.
Right.
You know?
The cutest parts of the story.
Exactly right. We get pretty much all of it from Luke, but the wise men.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The cutest parts of Christmas, like the parts that when you set up your creche at home, that's Luke. He's got the shepherds,
right,
you know.
Right.
And the angels and all the things.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So that's why I just love Luke for all those reasons. And, like I said, he's like my home base. He's the guy I like to sit down and talk with.
I was just thinking about when you were saying how lostness is such a pervasive theme in Luke. I think it was Nadia Bolz-Weber. I heard her once using this metaphor of how one time she was in an airplane and it was kind of coming down to land, and this was somewhere out west, and she looked out the window and she could see these really vast fields, like agricultural fields, and there was some sort of sprinkler system that was moving in a circle. And so what she observed is that this sprinkler, because it was moving in a circle, was covering, you know, the areas under which the sprinkler part fell very easily, but because the fields themselves were squares, the corners weren't being watered.
The corners weren't getting hit, right?
And so she uses that as she called, you know, was thinking about how in our society that's kind of an apt metaphor for the ways in which some people are in that circle getting all the water, you know, quote unquote water that they need, but how Jesus would be interested in who's in the corners, like who's not being met, not being nourished, who's not being, you know, watered, to carry forth the metaphor. And so that image is sort of in my mind as we're thinking about Luke's Jesus and this lostness theme and that sort of thing. So had to share that because it came to mind.
It's a beautiful image, and I mm-hmm. think people will understand very easily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about, you know, Luke's gospel, going back to the Good Samaritan, you know, it ends with go and do likewise. Mm-hmm.
You know? Right.
It's not just Jesus's work, right?
Yeah.
It's
get out to the corners.
Find what's mm-hmm. in the corners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's a really huge, like I said, piece of what I think it is that we're supposed to be doing as Christian people in the 21st century.
Right. Well, and that's such a good, sometimes I think when I initially heard, when we were brainstorming about Lent for the Lost, Longing to be Found, I was thinking of it in more of like a pastoral way, like the sense of longing that I have, that you have, that we have, like that's, or even sort of eschatological, like the long-term longing and hopes that we have. But there is there also the conviction of there's a lot of people out there longing for to be found, and how, you know, our faith being incarnational is such that we have something to say and to do about that, that it's not just about like acknowledging lostness and longing to be found. It's about being part of reaching out to people who feel lost or who have felt, you know, on the outsides, in the corners, if you will. And so Lent, we think so often about it being this contemplative time, and it is, but balancing like contemplation and action and doing something about acknowledging who is being lost and longing to be found.
That's a hard thing in our world, right? That being and doing stuff. Am I more invested in being and learning from my own sense of God's oneness in my life?
Right.
Or am I called to be more focused on doing and actually teaching that to other people, helping somebody get food?
Right.
It's always a tough balance. And I think sometimes we tend to fall into one or two categories. Some of us are busy, 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 busy.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And others, you know, are so content that they're you know, are maybe so blessed that, that they don't feel that need to be busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably a lot of our listeners out there as well, too. Like, I don't have enough time in my day to be contemplative.
Right.
Or really, you know, spend much more than the time in this podcast to look at a five-verse text
right.
to sort of dig into it a little more deeply.
Right.
You know, Lent, I think, is, you know, it's, we were talking on the way over here, it's sort of a more modern thing for Presbyterians. Mm-hmm. It's part of what I think some of the scholars would call the liturgical renewal in the Presbyterian and Reformed churches. Probably started in the 70s and 80s. I think our grandparent Presbyterians didn't much talk about Lent very often. And we sort of have refit the church with the liturgical seasons and the calendar. But I do think it's good for us to take a period of time every year to really contemplate on sin and forgiveness, mortality, death, life eternal, you know, really dig into this. You know, I finished my work on the third day.
Mm.
Like, as a reminder that we need Jesus to do that work on the third day. We need that tomb to be empty in order to settle ourselves and root ourselves in ultimate hope. And I think remembering those things, like Lent begins on Ash Wednesday, and getting your ashes and being reminded that, you know, God formed all life from the dust, including ours, I think that's an incredibly important thing to do each year. It's what helps us from, it helps us control our heads from getting too big.
Totally.
I mean, if you really take it seriously, how am I not living into the way that God has called me into my fullness? If you really were honest with yourself, everybody, including me, is going to have a pretty long list.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's such a good equalizer, too. Like, I'm thinking right now about how many people are, you know, convinced that they're right. Just exactly what we were talking about earlier, that our unwillingness to say I could be wrong. And so, you know, getting the ashes, it's a reminder of our mortality. And it's also this equalizer of, like, we're all just created from dust.
Yes.
Just kind of a good reminder of, like, God is God and we are not God. And that is a reminder we often need. Well, we've talked a little bit about how Lent has been, you know, relative to the life of our particular theological tradition, a little newer. But in your own life, what has been sort of the change of your experience of Lent? What did it look like when you were a kid, and what does it look like now?
So, full disclosure to the listeners, Ann told me she was going to ask me this, as we were walking over to our little makeshift podcast studio thing. And I'm so excited she asked me about this.
Yay!
Lent could not have been more different in Louisiana than it is anywhere in North Carolina,
right,
still.
Right.
It was a big deal. Like at LSU baseball games, for example, on Fridays at this time of the year, they don't serve, when I was a kid, they didn't serve hot dogs or hamburgers. They only served fish.
Meat. Huh, interesting.
Fish. So that they switched the whole menu because during Lent, Catholic people
right.
don't eat red meat. Uh-huh. They only eat fish.
Right.
Think about Mardi Gras. Like, mm-hmm. We're recording this on what's called Lundi Gras, which is Monday, and then tomorrow is Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. Like, that whole thing is about, like, having your last blast
right. yep.
before you get your ashes on Wednesday.
Right. And then the right? fun's over.
And then the fun's yeah. over. Like, you got, and they took it seriously. Like, my grandmother, who was as devout a Catholic woman that has ever lived, would pray her rosary every day during Lent. Like,
wow.
She went to Mass constantly during Lent. Like, the culture shifted for those 40 days.
Uh-huh.
And it was just apparent everywhere. Like we go around town here in Raleigh, and you may see a third of the people that have ashes on their head.
Right.
In the New Orleans of my youth, it was 100%.
That's so interesting.
It was everybody got ashes.
Wow.
And it was just, it shaped the culture, and it marked the way that we kept time
right.
during that time of year. You know, giving up something for Lent was a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't come home and just say, I'm giving up, you know, bubble gum. That wasn't going
right.
to, that wasn't going to, I didn't teach you the sacrifice that Jesus made
right.
for you.
You better really ask something of you.
Exactly. Like, yeah. You got to feel it, kid.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that was, when I got from New Orleans to Davidson near Charlotte, I was like blown away. That was one of the biggest differences I noticed in the winter right away.
Oh, that's so interesting. So you were like, what's everybody doing? Yeah,
where's
ash Mardi Gras? Crosses
and where's Mardi Gras? And where's my ash cross? And
right.
and what were people doing eating meat on Friday?
Yeah,
in the school cafeteria, there was no, like, that right. wasn't the school lunch.
Right. Which there is a loss there for you, because there's something about communal like movement toward through this season that is really gorgeous, and that sort of like communal accountability too, because it's a lot easier to sort of forget about the journey through Lent when it's not as obvious to you when you're walking throughout your days, but to have that sort of insistence at school and at church and at a baseball game and all of those things that, like, no, this is where we are as a community and we're moving through this time together, that really adds something.
We're all in it together.
Right.
Like,
right.
Nobody's particularly happy.
Sure.
You know? But we're all unhappy together.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know what that's called.
Whatever it is.
There's got to be a fancy German word for that, don't you think?
Yes.
There's got to be a fancy German word that describes it. Like one of those words like Zeitgeist
yes.
or Schadenfreude.
Yeah. There's listeners, if you could write in, if you know what that word is, just let us know.
That thing where I'm unhappy, but everybody else is. And yes. And I'm okay because nobody's
right,
happy.
Right, we're
exactly.
gaining something from that. Well, what do you think, Christopher, about, you know, we talked about the idea of giving things up. Some people would say that Lent is also an opportunity to take something on. So what is it for you personally in terms of your kind of like spiritual practices or the way that you are moving through Lent in this year? You know, it could be different from year to year. What is speaking more to you right now? Is the idea of giving something up, of taking something on? What are you thinking about?
I usually tend to think of taking something up, because to mm-hmm. take something up, I've got to sacrifice time for something else
right.
that I have been doing.
Right.
And it gives me two things. One, it makes me really consider how important the thing was
right.
that I had been doing relative to this new thing I'm going to do with that allotment of time.
Right.
It does. And two, I'd say probably 60% of the time, maybe 70, I'll end up keeping the new thing I've taken on
mm-hmm.
and then giving up the old thing.
Mm-hmm.
So giving up, this is really low bar here, but giving up a devotional book that gives me great comfort and take on what I used to call the 5-5-5 or the 7-7-7 plan, which is 7 minutes of Bible study,
mm-hmm.
7 minutes of prayer,
mm.
7 minutes of silence. Like,
mm-hmm.
every day. Just I like 21 that. Minutes or 5:55.
Yeah.
You know, and read something in the Bible. Like for me, if I was going to do that this year, I'm not going to read Luke.
Right. Because that's your home.
Because that's home base. I'm going to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read the Psalms because I'm well on the record about how much I love the yes. book of Psalms.
Right.
But, you know, some stuff that I tend to avoid, like, I don't really love the Deuteronomy texts when they're in the lectionary much, or the ones from 2 Kings, but there's some really beautiful things in there. There's some really gorgeous narratives about the ancient Israelites and the lives that they led and the people that they were. And so that's where I would go for that. The 5 minutes you know, of silence is really hard for me, or the 7 minutes of silence is really hard for me.
Yeah.
And probably the easiest for me is the 7 minutes or 5 minutes of prayer.
Right.
Like if I just sit down and start a list, I can find stuff to pray about.
Right.
You know, for hours on end. That's one that I've done in the past. I've also, when I was in Charlotte before I came to Harbor Raleigh, would do extra hours at the Urban Ministry Center back before we had kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But do extra time with the homeless in Charlotte. I learned a lot from them, and I never regretted spending the extra time with them.
Right.
But in order to do that, I had to give up something else,
right.
which was reading time or some of the time I spent prepping for the Bible study I taught. But,
right.
you know,
right.
I was learning great things no matter what. So I tend to be more of a pick something up.
Yeah.
And then even if that means I have to put something down,
right.
but I focus on the picking something up. As a way of trying to be a little more devoted
right.
From Ash Wednesday through Holy Week.
Which is helpful. You pointed out two things that I hope will be instructive for people. And the first one is that I had a mentor say one time that it's always good to have one spiritual practice that feels like home and one that feels like a stretch.
Oh, yeah.
And so by doing that 5:55 or 7:77, like you are kind of hitting both. Like it's the silence is a little, it's a stretch. And then like reading scripture or praying feels like home. And so I love encouraging people to have both.
I agree. Like you and I are not the two most naturally silent people.
No, maybe the least on the pastoral staff
for sure. And so the silence really stretches me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a big struggle for me over the years. But again, I've never regretted doing it.
Right. It's good for
us. It's really good for us. It just takes me a little while to settle my brain down.
Right, right. Well, and the other thing is, I love that you pointed out the seasonality of this, that when you were, you know, when you didn't have children and life looked different, Lent could look one way, and now Lent can look a different way. And so just an encouragement for people who are listening that, you know, you move through Lent within the confines of the life that you actually have. And so if that looks like 3:33 because what you have is 9 minutes.
1:11.
Yes, that is better than zero. And we would encourage you to take whatever time you can. I mean,
unless you're at an LSU baseball game on a Friday night. During Lent. Lent does take on the context of the life that you have.
You're exactly right. So,
and I think, you know, again, just before we wrap up, whenever that needs to be, just I think all of us are longing to be found in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And Lent gives us a chance to say to God, hey, I'm a little lost here.
Yeah.
And so with my 3:33 or my 5:55
right.
or with my study of Luke 13:31-35, Help me get a little closer, come a little closer to you so that I can be found by you in some new ways this year.
Right. Oh, that's a good word. Well, friends, I think we have come to the end of this podcast. It has been a delight, and we are grateful to be journeying with you both in person and virtually when we're worshiping, and also in this sort of extra time with you that we have through the podcast. So we'll see you for the next episode.